I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories. And for the first time, they're ready to tell them. These are the Narco Warriors. On the show this week, the investigator becomes the target.
The spooks had told us at the embassy, this isn't just a warning, this is a real threat.
The airport that became a temple of crime.
It was possible to rip off a suitcase at every single terminal at Heathrow.
And how not to sample a cocaine stash.
If you want to die, go ahead and do that, because you don't know what's in there.
So don't believe everything you see in the movies. This is Narco Warriors. Welcome to Narco Warriors. And I think, first of all, I want to introduce your own backgrounds and careers. Phil, I'm starting with you, mate, because obviously you and I were in the same secondary modern back in the 70s in South London.
Yes, we both failed our 11 pluses.
Indeed we did. We're both 11 plus failures who've made good further down the line, I suppose you could say. But I remember we were sitting down, we'd done our A-levels, we didn't have the results. I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I didn't really know how I was going to do it. But you had a very firm idea of what you were going to be doing. You said to me, I'm joining Customs and Excise. Can I just... Yeah, tell us that story, where you got the idea from and what you did.
I got the idea from something I'd read in a book, and I was very lucky enough to join Customs in September 1972. And the next couple of years I spent doing sort of preventive work in London and Dover, rummaging ships, searching containers, doing some work dealing with alcohol, tobacco, landing and shipping work, as it was called at the time, making sure people had paid the right amount of duty when they imported goods. And then I was lucky enough in 1974 to get selected for HM Customs and Excise Investigation Branch, which actually morphed very quickly into the Investigation Division.
One of the reasons you wanted to join was because you thought customs... I think probably in those days people would have thought about a customs officer, somebody at the port, he's in a uniform, he looks in your suitcase, you might put a cross or a tick on it in chalk or something like that. But at the same time, Customs, UK Customs and Excise was changing into a drug investigation department as well, wasn't it?
It was.
That was the exciting
part. The very, very, very early days of drugs in the 70s. And when I joined the investigation side in 1974, we were dealing mostly with cannabis. And it exploded quite quickly. And therefore, the staffing exploded with it to match it. And I think in those days we were lucky enough that the scale of the problem was matched with the scale of the resources. That's not the case these days, of course. So we expanded very quickly, and I was very lucky to work for a few months on an intelligence team led by a guy called John Cooney, who was a tremendous leader and manager and inspirational person. I learnt a lot from him, but that was just about how you handled intelligence, how we gathered intelligence, handled intelligence, how we stored it, how we disseminated it, how we got that information to the officers on the ground quickly, how we got it to our partners in the police and other agencies. That was a great grounding for me. And then I went to my first operational team a few months later, which was called Drugs J, the Juliets, which dealt with importations of drugs through the post. One of the advantages of joining customs is it was a national force. We worked all over the UK, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Therefore, we weren't restricted to working in a constabulary or a regional area. So right from the start of my career, all of us were working all over the UK and abroad, which was great and I enjoyed it.
Graham, tell us your origin story with customs and excise. Where did you get the idea and when did you remember when you applied and what the first job was?
Yeah, I do, Lindsay. It a different story from Phil. I'd been at college in Dundee and had failed miserably in my second year. And my dad got me a job on a building site. It was actually the expansion of Keeler's Marmalade Factory in Dundee. Keeler's, of course, very famous for making marmalade. And, you know, Dundee, the home of jam and journalism. And I just happened one lunchtime to be sitting having my cup of tea and sandwich. And saw the paper, saw an advert for customs and excise, guy in a uniform, a bit as you described it, looking, you know, at passengers coming in. I thought, oh, maybe this is for me. I applied for the job. And in those days, you couldn't apply directly. You had to join the civil service. So I applied to the civil service and had an interview with them. Meanwhile, I got a job on a management structure with Safeway's Food Stores, which is now Morrison's. And I was waiting to hear from the civil service, didn't hear anything. And then eventually, the January of the following year, that was 1975, I was told I'd been accepted and my post would be to Southall VAT office. I went in as an EO executive officer and joined in 1975. I'd obviously the decision to make, was this going to be for me coming down to London? And of course, I hadn't a clue what Southall was like. And that's how I joined, came down. And of course, in those days, you were put into a civil service hostel. So I was
really?
I was in Craven Hill, sharing a room with two other guys for about 6 months till I found a flat. So I reported for duty at what was the collection headquarters. A collection is an area that customs had in Shaftesbury Avenue, and then made my way down by train to Southall VAT office. And it was a bit of a shock, to say the least.
Yeah, a bit of a trek too, actually.
Yeah,
in those days.
Yeah, by train. And of course, a very diverse, multicultural place, Southall, for which from a young country bumpkin from a small village in Scotland, it was a bit of an eye-opener, but very interesting. And so as a VAT officer and a VAT inspector, the dreaded VAT inspector, and the reason for that is, of course, VAT had been introduced in the UK in 1973, and HM Customs and Excise was assigned to be the people who would manage and oversee VAT. And that is a history going back. The tax before VAT was called purchase tax. And of course, the famous purchase tax evader is one Richard Branson.
What did he do wrong?
It was when he started Virgin Records. He was meant to be taking the actual discs out of the country, but he didn't actually take them. He would take them out and then bring them back. So he was evading paying the purchase tax, which if he'd sold them here, he would have to do. He admitted his faults, and I think in his book he does sort of say this was all a big mistake and that. But he was fined for it.
Did you enjoy the work?
Yeah, it was. I was very lucky. Like Phil, through our careers, you meet some very, very good people. And my senior officer then was a guy called Dave Richardson. And he taught me all the basics of the things that later in your career you come to realise it's that. You were interacting with businesses and people every day. You know, you were out doing four visits a week. So you were getting to learn your trade. You didn't realise it at the time, but it just started to come to you, and I seem to have an aptitude for it.
I mean, what was working for UK Customs and Excise like in terms of its culture, the people, your bosses?
Certainly the investigation side was. It was very much a family, and we got to know nearly everybody in the service over, you know, a few months, because you were working all over the country, working with them. They were coming down to London and working down here as well. And that was great, because you meet, as Graham said, a wide variety of people. And both of us have had sort of mentors during our career. And I met some of my mentors very early on, as Graham did. And they were my mentors in a career of 36 years dealing in law enforcement. And in my side and Graham's side, in those 36 years, it was mostly dealing with drug trafficking. We learnt our tradecraft, and we learnt it incrementally. For me, I learnt it by doing drugs coming through the post, then working on an operational team that did cannabis coming through cargo and freight to the UK for a year. Then I went on to the teams, drugs teams B and C, which were the target teams, which worked against organised criminals who were smuggling cannabis into the UK, all over the UK.
The point, it was largely cannabis in those days. It sounds like it's like an outcome of the swinging 60s, really, when drugs became part of the culture.
I think,
and cannabis was everywhere.
Yeah, cannabis was the prevalent drug, but there was amphetamine, there was ecstasy, and there was LSD. And we would deal with those. Now, there was a little bit of heroin, a little bit of cocaine, but not that much in the early 70s. It was mostly herbal cannabis, cannabis resin, and occasionally cannabis oil. So it was a real mixture of drugs. But the incremental learning your trade was vital to us, because you got to know drug traffickers were doing, their thinking. So after I'd done a couple of years in drugs B and C, I went to drugs A, which was called Alpha, the Intercept team. And Intercept supported a lot of the major operations.
Now, what is it now? Intercept team. What does Intercept mean?
Well, it's interception of communications. But in our day, traditional interception was, in the early 70s, was landlines. We moved later into the ability to intercept mobile phones. But we were very, very good at it. It was important, because Intercept gave you and gives you what the target is thinking in real time. It gives you their timings, it gives you their intentions, it gives you their capabilities, and therefore you can respond to that. So we worked very closely when I was in Alpha with the operational teams. We didn't control them, we didn't run them, that was the operational commander, but we helped them and advised them and told them what was happening.
The story I tell you about cannabis, and this is jumping ahead in my career a little bit, I was on a heroin drugs team, and we were out doing searches on a particularly big case. In those days, we used to use what was called the writ of assistance. It was like an open-ended warrant. It was something that was given to Customs and Excise and signed by the Queen, and it allowed you to go and search premises without a warrant.
And that was a very historic document. Oh, it went back hundreds of years, didn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
And so we went out. But if you went out after, I think, was it midnight, Phil, or 11 o'clock? 11 o'clock, you had to be accompanied by a police officer. We get some CID guys to come out and help us to search this premises. The people we were looking for weren't there. We searched, and we found there's a suitcase there. And I could see that the seams of the suitcase were bulging. And I thought, there's a concealment of some sort in there. I'd never come across cannabis oil before, but I thought, I wouldn't be surprised if this is cannabis oil. And of course, I've got this policeman next to me who's got a knife. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to put it in there. And I said, I wouldn't if I was you. And he said, no, I'm going to do it. And I went, for fuck's sake, don't do that. And of course, he did. Didn't listen to what I did. And in it went, and out came all the cannabis oil all over him. But it was just another learning thing of when you're around drugs, just be careful. You know, we all see it on the cop shows, don't we? Yeah. The guy doing, getting his finger out, licking his finger and putting it into the coke and doing it. Yeah, if you want to die, go ahead and do that, because you don't know what's in there.
Phil, you used the word intercept, you know, not casually, but quite quickly. But what intercept, you know, the public don't realise they're being listened to. Now, if you're going to, obviously you needed to get a legal document, a sign-off from the Home Office to do an intercept in those days? What was the procedure?
We had to get individual warrants signed personally by the Home Secretary, and that's still the case today. I think the difficulty these days is, as I mentioned earlier, that the rapidly changing technologies environment, but you've also got a new generation of technology-enabled criminals and terrorists. You've got offshoring of capabilities. It means you can't access the technology in the UK. So it's very, very hard for police and law enforcement agencies to maintain crucial intercept capabilities in today's world. I've been lucky in my career to be in charge of customs intercept capabilities in the UK and around the world. Also, in the run-up to the Serious Organised Crime Agency, I was the director at the National Criminal Intelligence Service, looking after their intercept for a while. And then in soccer, I took charge of intercept again for all police forces in the UK and soccer, and had a very good team of people around me that really understood it. But these days, it's increasingly hard, and it's also increasingly expensive.
Of course, that in the UK, you can't use intercept evidence in court. You can in the US, can't you?
Actually, and around the world, there's only a couple of countries which have intercept as intelligence, and we've had it for a long time. But for us, it's vital in the UK, and I was lucky enough to sit on a number of committees for many, many years, some of which are still sitting now, looking at intercept as evidence or possible intercept as evidence. The real basic reason why we don't use intercept as evidence in the UK is we need to protect capabilities, our equities, our tradecraft. People don't understand what we do, and therefore they don't understand our vulnerabilities and our weaknesses. And we're not going to change that.
Could I go back to some of those early times? You mentioned drugs coming through the post when you first began in the 70s, and you then targeted some of this post, and then you put in dye into the packages.
We went to generally the London Overseas Mail Office. There were a couple of other international entry points into the UK. Picked up the parcels or the packages, took them back to the office, substituted the drugs for an innocuous substance, generally put in gentian violet dye and sometimes little triggers to know when the person had opened the parcel, and then we delivered the parcel to the premises accordingly. It was great experience for us because you were actually taking the drugs to the villain. You had to get the villain to accept it and then prove the case afterwards. We were learning. We were doing two or three of these jobs a week, speaking to people, arresting people, interviewing people, preparing the case papers and later appearing in court. Great experience, great exposure, and building up a little bit of an intelligence network as well, trying to turn some of them into
informants. So developing tradecraft, which was particular to customs and excise, right?
Absolutely, because customs under the drugs policy at the time, both the government, was responsible for the international trafficking in drugs. The police were responsible for distribution of drugs in the UK. Of course, there's a grey area in between, which we occasionally used to bump into our police colleagues and they used to bump into us, but generally it worked pretty well.
Graham, how did the police, in your memory, respond to the idea that actually Customs and Excise were doing the same job as them, really, investigating serious crime?
There was headbutting over it. There was over cases you would come across. I remember the first time I really saw that was in Operation Snowball, which was a big cocaine case that involved utilisation of baggage handlers at Heathrow. And while the investigation was going on, which was covert investigation into this, people on the sidelines would end up getting arrested by the police. They would maybe have drugs in their car, do this, and of course, quite often, they then would want to talk to the police and give them information about the bigger thing, which was, of course, the case we were working on. And therefore, there had to be a degree of then cooperation with the police to make sure that it was deconflicted for them to get the big picture.
And Graham, you mentioned a little while ago Operation Snowball, based on Heathrow.
In 1980-81... I transferred over to the drugs arena. They started this major investigation into what was Operation Snowball, and it involved basically baggage handlers at Heathrow in customs parlance, would say they were ripping off the suitcases from the belt. In other words, the suitcase on the belt had been put on in in South America, and the handlers knew it was coming. They'd rip the bag off, take it away, put it in the van and drive it out of the airport, avoiding security.
And the bags were full of drugs.
And and in this case, it was cocaine. When the case went down, it was a Sunday when they were trying to follow it, and things didn't go well, I think is an easy way to say it. The observations and following drugs live, it's again not like the TV. The unfortunate thing was on that case, it involved police corruption as well. And the actual people we suspected behind it and behind the police corruption, unfortunately, we couldn't prove the case or that to the satisfaction of the jury, and a lot of the guys on it got found not guilty. Again, which is always disappointing. But one thing you quickly learn, and I think it's an important point, and it's something you try to instill. It was instilled in me, and I then instilled it in younger members when I became more experienced. At the end of the day, your job is to get it to court. Do everything properly to get it there. Gather your evidence. Give your evidence in court, and that is your job. You can't control what a jury will then do, and therefore, even though you know somebody is guilty and it hasn't been proven, you just have to walk away at the end of the trial and go, we did the best we could, and the jury has decided they're not guilty.
Going back to the early 70s, my first major case when I joined drugs teams B and C, the target teams looking at organised criminal smuggling cannabis to the UK, was a similar type of job, really. The couriers would fly out to Pakistan. They would fill two suitcases full of cannabis resin. They would then interline the bags back through Rome, back to the UK. Interline meaning they didn't have to touch the bags themselves. The couriers would then fly back. In this particular case, the Guardia de Finanza at the Rome airport actually found the drugs and substituted them for us and sent them on to the UK. At Heathrow Airport, in the Alitalia plane, a baggage loader stole the two suitcases and handed them to a person in a Trust House 40s van that provided the catering for Alitalia and therefore had an airside pass. That person then took the bags to the King William IV public house out near the airport and handed them over to two people in the car park. Sadly, those two people were both Metropolitan Police officers, serving officers at the time. Fast forwarding, with many of my colleagues, spent months pulling the papers together and presenting them. And then I spent 9 months at the Old Bailey as the case officer with counsel, doing what we thought was a pretty good job to convince the jury that these people were all guilty of drug trafficking offences. In fact, the two police officers and their informant, who was the facilitator, were found not guilty. And, you know, for me, this was my first major long trial at the Old Bailey, where I was the case officer. I was sort of very, very, very upset that these people were found not guilty.
Must be very, very demoralising. It sounds like an open and shut case to me.
Both those police officers were subsequently dismissed from the force and were suspended, obviously, and then dismissed. But we convicted the baggage loader at the airport. We convicted the Trust House 40 driver. We convicted the couriers. We convicted another person. The principal, who we'd arrested in London and put a lot of time into actually catching, was never convicted because he was granted bail, much to our opposition, by
a Syria judge
and went back to Pakistan, unsurprisingly, so everybody could throw the blame at him. That was, you know, a pretty typical case of people at the airport abusing their positions of authority.
It's called Thief Row in those days.
It was, and
probably still is.
We did a lot of work at the airport over the years, and lots of the guys and girls I worked with spent an awful lot of time at Heathrow, Gatwick and other airports and other ports. And certainly in the early 70s and 80s, it was possible to rip off a suitcase at every single terminal at Heathrow from any flight in the world at any time of the day or night, any day of the year. If you put that in a terrorist perspective, that's quite frightening. But interestingly enough, a lot of the people who we worked on at the airport were absolutely against helping any form of terrorism. So they would smuggle anything other than something to do with terrorism. And it was hard work. And, you know, whether they were in the cargo loading sheds stealing freight, whether they were in Liverpool docks, Newport docks, Felixstowe docks, Harwich docks, or wherever, there is a rip-on team that were able to rip off containers, rip on bags, rip off freight, rip on freight. And that was the same the world over. And it's one of the reasons why we had to work internationally with our partners around the world, was to make them aware of what was happening at their airports and see if they could tighten up on the security. But the reality was, as you said earlier, Linz, it was thief row. And they weren't just interested in stealing bags of drugs. They'd steal anything of value from the airport. When I was in a different job as a senior manager looking after investigations in southern England, I commissioned a bit of work through a good friend of mine, Alan Percival, who spent months looking at every single port and airport in the UK, and also some areas where there were illegal landing strips. And the conclusion of that very, very useful document was, yes, it was still happening, and it was possible to rip off a container from any port in the UK, and it was possible to rip off a bag from any airport in the UK. So that shows you the scale of corruption and insider threat at these places.
I think it's, as we always say, it's a form of smuggling. Nothing's new in smuggling. Everything, you go back and think about it, what was coming over from France in the 1700s and that was brandy being smuggled on boat into the UK. What's changed? Nothing really. It's people now. You know, it forms of smuggling and that rip on, rip off is still prevalent. And it, as Phil says, I think maybe the morals of some of the people there now may have changed, because, of course, terrorist groups will look to infiltrate and get people working in those positions. So to me, that does present a real threat to the UK.
Graham, I mean, at times in the 70s, this was a dangerous job. A man called Peter Bennett, a colleague of all of yours at the time, was actually shot during an operation and died. Can you tell me about that operation?
It's one of those things that live with you. Because I remember it was a Friday afternoon and I was on the VAT team. I hadn't moved over to drugs yet. And a number of us had the radios on, which were the radios where we're following the case. You could hear what was going on. And it became apparent that some major serious incident had happened. And
so the squad were following a team of smugglers who had some drugs with them.
Basically a big cannabis job. Yeah. And they went to arrest them. Peter Bennett, along with a police officer, went to arrest them. Unfortunately, he pulled a gun out and shot Peter, who subsequently died.
Peter Bennett was one of our friends, and I knew him particularly well because I'd worked with him. I'd gone over to the briefing and actually had seen Peter coming out of the office after the briefing and had a quick chat with him, and then went back to Alpha, and we were monitoring the communications of the surveillance team out following the baddies when the incident happened. And in fact, it was a terrible day for all of us. So it was a dangerous job. We weren't armed at the time in customs officers, but we did take the police with us on many operations who were armed.
I think the point we'd make is in those early days, in the early 80s, we alluded it to earlier, we weren't a big organisation. The investigation division weren't big. You know, we had a London office, we had regional offices, Manchester, Bristol, Glasgow. But everybody knew everybody. You may not have worked with them, but because of the number of people that we were, you knew everybody. So when something happened like that, it did have a real effect on you because you knew the person.
Yeah, it was part of the family, and Peter was a part of the family, and he was also a good part of the family. He was a great investigator, really good guy. And it was just bad luck, I'm afraid, at the end of the day. It was nothing to do with poor planning or lack of operational performance on the day. It was just bad luck, and these things do happen. And I think if I'm honest, I think, and I'm sure Graham will support me, over the 35 plus years we were involved in law enforcement, we were very lucky that not more of our officers were killed. But generally, the case is that we did plan operations really well. We took necessary precautions. We took armed police with us. We would take special forces with us. And depending on the scale of the threat, we'd meet it by the appropriate response. But there was a push at one stage to arm customs officers in the early 80s, mid 80s, because we were doing so many jobs against nasty, horrible people. But that didn't manifest itself. Many of us went on firearms courses, in fact. And when we were on our DLO courses, we also went on firearms courses as well. Some of our DLOs overseas did carry firearms, but they carried them for personal protection, not to intervene against drug traffickers.
I think the legislation, even in our time, was we could be armed with a cutlass. Which goes back to Robbie Burns' days. And that. But I don't get the... At that time, it was never repealed, because that's why we were looking at us carrying guns. And I think somebody found this quaint thing that, yeah, we could still have a cutlass. So, of course, you can imagine the bit of fun that was had around that. Everybody coming into the office, you know, looking for a sword to go out on. And
times have changed. But, you know, if I just give you a quick insight, when I took over later in my career management of the Western Hemisphere liaison, drug liaison officers based there, my first thing that came on my desk was to pay for a number of armoured cars which we'd sent to Colombia. And these were American sourced Cherokee Jeeps, heavily armoured with bulletproof windows. And the boys and girls had just received them down in Colombia, and they phoned me up in the afternoon to say, got our cars, really good boss, but the windows don't open. Well, me being slightly naive, said, well, of course they don't. They're bulletproof, you know, bombproof windows. They said, but when we drive out of Bogota, boss, we have to open the windows to pay the tolls on the motorways. So now we have to get out of the cars. So we sent those cars back to America to have different windows put on. That was an extremely expensive day out. That was my first trip to Colombia, which was in March 1993. The Colombian National Police Anti-Narcotics Force were, with the DEA, still chasing Escobar. But our guys in those days had permission to carry firearms for personal protection, but they also individually had a three-man protection team guarding them 24 hours a day. So can you imagine doing your job with a three-man protection team? Can you imagine just going about your daily life? My wife had a three-man protection team, and the kids had protection teams. I chose not to have one at the time, but my wife did, and the kids had them. And it was really hard work for a few months. Fortunately, in Colombia, things started to get a little bit better, and we dropped the protection teams, but they remained themselves down there.
Were there ever any occasions in your individual careers where you actually did carry a firearm?
Certainly, from my perspective, no. When I was overseas, we could get permission from the host authority to have our weapon at home for personal protection, whether that was in me in Thailand or when I was in America. But they weren't officially, if we had one, they weren't officially given firearms. They were weapons which we had with the authority of the police to have them at home.
Were you ever in a situation, Phil, where you felt it would have been better if you did have a firearm?
I've been in a number of situations where I felt I would be very, very happy having a firearm, particularly when I was overseas, where we did a lot of work on our own or just the two of us doing things, and therefore we didn't always have the backup you'd wanted. But I think I said earlier on that, you know, we got away with it, and that's good news.
Of course, in America, every law enforcement officer has about 10 guns. And of course, I'd go out with them and they'd ask me what I was carrying that day. Yeah. And of course, I'd look at them and say, well, I don't have a gun. And they'd just be incredulous that they didn't believe that you could do your job
really
without a gun. And I just try to explain our background, how we hadn't, you know, ever had to carry a gun. And but like Phil, there were occasionally a few situations you were in, you were thinking, I'd like to have a gun.
Phil, how do you explain to your children and your wife that they need a bodyguard because somebody might want to hurt them?
It's a difficult one. My view was for the kids was more of a light touch. They had a police officer that was accompanying them in the school bus to school, and there was a police car behind the bus going to school, and that was there because it was a difficult situation we were going through. My kids at that time were 7 and 10, so they found it unusual. My wife found it really, really difficult to have a personal protection team go with her shopping down the road, and she did not like it at all. But my wife understood it because of the scale of the threat. There was a very specific threat against us that was real and credible, and we'd been told, the spooks had told us at the embassy, this isn't just a warning, this is a real threat. So, you know, the Thai police immediately responded to that threat and said, what do you want? So the embassy had, first time I'd ever known it in my career, our embassy in Bangkok had armed troops from a foreign nation within the embassy.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. It's an absolutely fascinating story and gives us some sense of the background to your own careers and life in customs and excise in the 1970s. In our next episode, we follow Phil and Graham to their foreign postings. Why the best intelligence is human intelligence, but only if you can trust what you're being told.
Somewhere along the line, an informant is going to be a problem.
Sharing spycraft secrets with allies in the field.
We had to train them to bug hotel rooms, to break into hotels, to defeat the alarms on some places. We had to train them to do surveillance.
And handling unexpected surprises along the way.
Eventually, they found a body in the water tank.
These are the narco warriors. Join us again soon.